Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and its Inforum division. I'm Dr. Joe Marshall, the founder of Alive and Free, an international violence prevention organization headquartered in San Francisco. Most of you know it as Omega Boys Club. I'm also the host of Street Soldiers on KMEL and your MC for tonight. You can find out more about the club and Inforum online at commonwealthclub.org. You can also follow them on Twitter using the handle at InformMSF. I guess it's at InformSF. And if you're keeping close tabs on tonight's conversation, we'll be live tweeting using the hashtag Black in the Bay Town Hall. We are all reeling, all of us, from what happened in Florida to Trayvon Martin. After the verdict, President Obama calling us to bring conversations about race relations to our communities. He said that there is no context for challenges that exist for African American boys, and I might add all members of the community, and that context is being denied. So tonight, we're here for a special town hall meeting, the politics of being black in the Bay Area, to bring some context to this conversation. Now, our speakers will share their stories and expertise so that we can share our perspectives and discuss how our values and laws define social justice in our daily lives. We'll start things off with San Francisco slam poet Sojourner Bradley, followed by American Civil Rights Laws 101 from Oakland civil rights attorney John Burris. Life straight out of Hunters Point. Good film. From filmmaker Kevin Epps. I'll follow that by talking to two students, Kaneja Han and Demondre Harrison from Bayview, about race and the education system. Pastor Michael McBride will help us find a pathway forward from our violence in our communities. Slam poet Oakland Joss Merchant of Youth Speaks will recite a poem about food in his Bay Area community. Nikki Henderson will tell us how one person can impact a community, in her case, by bringing fresh food access to West Oakland. Finally, Paul Henderson and Angela Glover-Backwell will tackle national and local public policy and what you can do about it. We want to give them the time they deserve, so we're going to jump right in with our first guest. Please welcome San Francisco slam poet Sojourner Bradley.
An open letter to whom it may concern. From day one, we are taught that nothing is bulletproof outside the womb. 17-year-old Trayvon Martin shot dead, armed with Skittles and an iced tea. 22-year-old Oscar Grant shot dead with his hands cuffed behind his back, armed with a plea on a New Year's Eve, while Sean's bell tolled in the distance as witness. They lay still as Emmett Till, his still shot descendants, their faces reduced to the covers of magazines. We are shell-shocked from birth, born both a warning shot and a call to arms. What is it to be born a threat yet impossible to protect from harm? Black souls juxtaposed between weighted barrels of lost hope and poverty, where police brandish hair trigger tippers that ricochet off black bodies. We live disembodied, taught our flesh is worthless, been Willie lynched into myth at the birth of this nation, depicted as savage, hooded beast, carnivorous with full clips, our skin synonymous to sin. Truth is, we live by the skin of our teeth, as the husks of our gutted shells, wrestling our humanity from the grips of oppression while forced into cauldrons of insanity. We are born bodies on fire, A collection of the scattered embers from the smoldered fires of riots gone quiet. Only trained ears can hear the pulse of Tulsa, Watts, Chicago, Oakland, and San Francisco in our veins. Resistance is in our blood, despite black and brown bodies maimed. Given drugs, given guns, and told to untie ourselves from the nooses we were born hanging from. A strange fruit, told to plant seeds of success, but the soil coated in our children's blood, while our mothers cry out with hollow throats asking, where is all this growth supposed to come from? Having to bury the fruit of their labor while stomaching the pains of their slain, a reminder that nothing was supposed to grow here in the first place. We struggle to dream at heights higher than the altitude of bullets that graze the sky, chest and thigh. Typical conversations around gun violence should never start with the gun itself. The gun is fear, wrapped around a steady hand and a trembling heart. The gun is a surrender, a giving up. Each shot fired is a million backs breaking past the last straw. We struggle with religion after watching our reflections crucified before our very eyes, our deaths made public. Having to watch black mouths permanently twisted into screams that silence sound. What happens when the gun is turned on us? Our flesh ripped apart till all that's left is glory exposed. Our limbs sprawled out like scarred spangled banners of exit wounds. The gun has no trigger deadlier than a justice system with its safety off. Typical conversations around gun violence should never start with the gun. They should start with solutions that seek to humanize our criminalized bodies. So this is an open letter. This is a call to action, a call to invest in a love that doesn't judge, but a love that can transform black and brown bodies into bodies worthy of being loved. Thank you.
I'm unfortunately the one who has to follow him. That was very, very impressive. I've been asked to talk. First, my name is John Burris, civil rights attorney who has been involved in many of the issues that have confronted us. The Trayvon Martin case, I've been involved in many racial profiling and certainly the various judicial systems themselves. And so when I think about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, I really think that it set forth a false expectation, because the case itself, from our point of view, was rooted in racial profiling and all the issues that related to that. Unfortunately, the criminal justice system is about due process. And notwithstanding what you think about how the case was tried or not, which I don't think was tried very well, the issues could not and did not get resolved. And we have seen that time and time again. The young man mentioned some of those cases, but many of those cases indicated that the criminal justice system cannot and has not given a fair just when African-American men have been killed under very questionable circumstances. So let me talk a little bit about the various two areas I think are important when you think about race in the criminal justice system here. Racial profiling is a huge, huge issue around this country, and the very criteria or that Trayvon was, the status that he had on that particular night, whether it was the clothes, the neighborhood, how he was walking, what he was doing, are not atypical in terms of how young men are looked at as they walk through various communities at any point in time. And Trayvon Martin himself obviously was racially profiled, but people like him are profiled all throughout this country every day. More importantly, it's done and more frequently by the police. Many of you may be aware that in New York City they have stop and frisk, where more than 800,000 people have been stopped over a very short period of time. Most of them have been African-Americans and brown people. And of that, only maybe 6% of all the people who have been stopped, in fact, have had any weapons or have been arrested. It shows that over 90% of these people have been stopped unjustifiably, and many of them have been placed in the criminal justice system as a consequence. Same thing happened in Philadelphia under their stop and frisk policies. But the Bay Area, where we are here, also has these significant issues around racial bias policing. Certainly in Oakland, where I am and involved in the police issues over there, there's no question that African Americans are stopped more aggressively, more routinely than members of other ethnic groups as well as Hispanics. These are the kinds of issues that are affecting the African-American community, because once you get stopped, rightly or wrongly, you can get your name placed in the criminal justice system, and everything can, a lot can flow from that, and most of it negatively. But the big issue that I think is confronting all of us when it gets down to race in this community or throughout the nation is the criminal justice system. Implicit in the enforcement of the criminal justice laws here is race. Race is an underlying factor. And if you look at the statistical data, starting from the moment a person is stopped by the police up until the time that he or she goes in the state prison system, every decision that is made has been race-based in a way that if a white person was involved in that same process, they would have gotten less time for that event. And so when you look at that, you've got to know that the criminal justice system is at the root of it. And when you follow that process on through, all you have to do is take a look. Look at what's in the, look at some of the various laws and the enforcement. The drug policy in the United States has been largely born on the back of African American men and women. That if you read more recently, the ACLU issued a report that says African American men and women are four times more likely to be arrested and charged with the possession of marijuana than people of other ethnic groups. If you look in terms of what's happening on three strikes and you're out, that is largely disproportionate. If you look at other areas, whether it's the death penalty or some of the others, you can see more significantly that people are caught up in this system. I want to tell you that when this happens, that and people are going to the criminal justice system, they essentially become second-class citizens. There's a lot of evidence out that says that you lose certain kind of benefits. You can't get a job. You can't get medical care. You can't get housing. You can't vote. These renders everybody that gets into this system into a second-class citizen. And the question is, how did that happen? And if you look at the data, you will see that it's because of the implicit racial bias and how the criminal justice system is, in fact, operating. And so when you look nationwide and you see what happened in the Trayvon Martin case, you could see that historically it was not likely that George Zimmerman was going to be convicted. We have not seen that in all the cases. On the other hand, if the shoe was reversed, he would have been convicted if it had been an African-American male. And we see that throughout the criminal justice system. So if we look forward and go forward, we have to think about how we communicate these various issues to various members of the society that is beyond the individuals who are involved. And so I would say to any of you that in order to increase your understanding of the African-American community or the brown community, you should, in fact, go out and visit other, I say, museums, different kinds of cross-cultural kind of activities, join various groups, and participate in a volunteer way so that you can develop some understanding. The problem we had with Trayvon Martin's jury, there was no understanding. They did not understand the African-American experience. They did not understand what racial profiling. And that has to be understood if, in fact, you're going to make a dent in bridging the gap and develop better communication between the races. Thank you.
Thank you, John Burris and Sojari Bradley. Next, we'll get some perspective on the issues our community is facing from Pastor Michael McBride from the Way Christian Center in West Berkeley. But first, documentary filmmaker Kevin Epps is here to share a clip from his film Straight Outta Hunters Point.
Here's a two-minute clip, less than 2 minutes. I think this intro of Straight Outta Hunters Point 2 is probably appropriate for this conversation. So we'll just get started with it. Let's cut, and I have a few words, a few remarks.
How does this make you feel?
It makes me feel terrible. I mean, I was here. I started working here in 1997. And, you know, you can kind of look at the panoramic pictures of graduating classes. Every year you will see a decline in African-American students, Latino students, and Polynesian students every single year. Three graduating African-American boys, it's just horrific. It really is. It's very discouraging as an educator.
If you do research on San Francisco, look at health inequalities, you can see, you know, the big thing, pediatric obesity. Number two, pediatric asthma. Babies got the highest asthma rate in the city, okay? Number three, immunization rates. But for some reason, that didn't jive with what I was seeing in clinic, because despite the fact that we were up to 96% immunization rates, I didn't treat one case of diphtheria, not one case of tetanus, you know, a few cases of whooping cough, but really, that's not what was killing our kids. So it turns out that the leading cause of early mortality in Bayview, right, the number one cause of years of life lost, is violence.
Thank you. So, appreciate that. So I've been, you know, I'm looking at this national dialogue going on, and I'm looking at how do we localize that. And so it's the most appropriate to look at some of the numbers that's going on in our local community, and we can see there's a breakdown in the system, there's a neglect, there's a lot of things that's happening to the black men, black male, black youth. I don't know where the panacea is or what great ideas people have, but it's not working for what's happening because the numbers are reflecting that. And I also know that because I'm in the community every day, and I see a whole group of young brothers that's disconnected to what's going on in, you know, all aspects, whether it's economic development and Baby Hunter's Point. You don't see our people working in their own community. We can't get a job in our own community where people done died and fought, and our people done came here and worked and labored to help this city be this resourceful city that it pledges to be. But then when you look at the numbers and you look at the criminal justice system and, you know, the underlying issue with education that's, you know, and then the criminal aspect, and it makes sense why things are where they are, because somebody is benefiting off of it. So it goes to maybe economic injustice where people are exploiting. You know, there's an exploitation factor going on with our community where people are making money off of us, off of the blood, off of the murder, demise. People are profiting off of that. So we got to really take a hard look at, you know, how we are involved in that, how we are complicit with that, whether we know it or don't know it. Money might be going to the wrong foundation. I don't know. I'm just posing these questions because I'm struggling with these things too, because I don't have the answers. People say, bro, you this, you that. But I'm like, yo, bro, this is deeper than the Atlantis. You know what I mean? The deeper you go, the deeper it gets. You know, so I want to say I'm hopeful, because there are beacons of light and things happening that keep you working and laboring and optimistic. But then the reality, man, is really dire, you know, and it's going to take work. It's just not going to happen. And it's going to take human interaction, because the people that you're speaking about and the people that have been left behind are human. So these are human stories. So prepare to love what you have to do to go out there and reach out, because it's emotional. So I ask you to, you know, get involved. You know, how to frame that national conversation about Trayvon, how to patronize Trayvon's story and the remarks by Obama by, you know, getting involved on a local level. And you can start with Bayview Hunter's Point or the Western Addition or some of these other communities that have been neglected and left behind with the digital divide and the way the economy is going right now. So thank you very much.
I want to say certainly good evening, everyone, and glad to be here. My name is Michael McBride, a pastor church in Berkeley, lead a national campaign called the Lifelines to Healing Campaign. I want to open my brief remarks invoking the words of possibly one of the greatest Americans that has ever lived. He says, "I want to discuss the race problem tonight, and I want to discuss it very honestly. I still believe that freedom is the bonus you receive for telling the truth, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And I do not see how we will ever solve the turbulent problem of race confronting our nation until there is an honest confrontation with it and a willing search for the truth and willingness to admit the truth whenever we discover it. So I want to use as a title for my lecture tonight, The Other America. And I use this title because there are literally two Americas. Every city in our country has this kind of dualism, this schizophrenia split at so many parts. And so every city ends up being two cities rather than one. There are two Americas. One America is beautiful for situation. In this America, millions of people have the milk of prosperity, the honey of equality flowing before them. In this America, the habitat of millions of people have food and material necessities for their bodies, culture and education for their minds, freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, children grow up in the sunlight of opportunity, but there is another America. This other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this other America, thousands and thousands of people, men in particular, walk the streets and search for jobs that do not exist. In this other America, millions of people are forced to live in vermin-filled, distressing housing conditions where they do not have the privilege of wall-to-wall carpeting, but all too often they end up with the wall-to-wall rats and roaches. Almost 40% of black families of America live in substandard housing conditions. In this other America, thousands of young people are deprived of an opportunity to get an adequate education. Every year, thousands finish high school reading at a 7th, 8th, and 9th grade level, not because they're dumb, not because they don't have the native intelligence, but because the schools are so inadequate and so overcrowded, so devoid of quality, so segregated, if you will, that the best in these minds can never come out. It's Dr. Martin Luther King. Gave that talk March 14th, 1968. We know the problems. What we don't know is how many people in our country and in this Bay Area value the lives of black and brown people enough to leverage our privilege to solve them. We know the hemorrhaging loss of life every day to gun violence and mass incarceration. What we don't know is, do our values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness actually apply to people who make mistakes or don't live their lives without errors? You see, what the Zimmerman verdict has done is remind us that we have two experiences in America. One experience is constantly reinforcing the fragility of black life, continuing to send the national message that black bodies are a threat, suspicious, criminal, and not free. The daily gun violence perpetuated in our urban neighborhoods demonstrate to us that the criminalizing and dehumanizing of black bodies has worked on our young people, so much so that they feel they must preemptively take out their enemy so as to feel safe. Long after the implications of this verdict have been exhausted, what will continue to be at stake, I believe, is our values. Our values pertaining to black bodies and the diminished humanity of each other. Our complicity by resting in our places of privilege, sitting on the sidelines with a front row seat observing the demise of our democracy. So what must we do? Well, I believe that all of us have to commit to resisting the false narrative that what happens to black boys, black men in urban communities is the sole responsibility of urban communities to solve. Here, I grew up in Hunters Point. Over the last 10 years, the African-American population of San Francisco has dropped from 10% to below 4%. The Shipyard Project is serving as a balm for the ongoing wounds that black communities faced in the Bay Area in terms of access to affordable housing and jobs. We must think about what does it mean to restore economic dignity and engine in our abandoned communities, often enacted by policies of elected officials who are supposed to have our back, but rather too often turn their back. The Shipyard is a rebuilding project, not a development project. And I think it is these kinds of reinvestments in our communities that require a national commitment, not just the commitment of urban communities themselves. Three things I believe we must do in this moment. I'm gonna act like y'all my church, all right? So just repeat after me. Say heal. Humanize. Organize. Say it again. Heal. Humanize. Organize. Heal. Go find someone who's different than you and hang out with them. Learn their story. Watch them cry and laugh and lie and tell the truth and squirm. and allow that healing power of relationship to trump our preconceived notions. Humanize. I challenge all of you to go see Fruitvale Station if you have not seen it. Fruitvale Station helps you and I to realize that there's more to our lives than the flattening of the criminality that is often associated with our bodies. Organize to end the mass incarceration of black and brown bodies. Take action steps to support ban the box policies in the state legislature right now, AB 218, that actually allows our folks to come home and not be legally discriminated against because they made mistakes in their lives. These are concrete things that I believe we can do. Personal responsibility, social responsibility, cultural responsibility, and national responsibility must not be pitted against each other as an either or, but rather discussed as a both and. In the great words of Abraham Joshua Heschel, a rabbi, he says, few are guilty, but all are responsible. May we all accept our responsibility. God bless you. Thank you.
Before I founded the Omega Boys Club, which is now alive and free, I was a middle school math teacher and an assistant principal right here in the city of San Francisco. And I learned the power of education to transform the lives of young boys and girls in the African American community. We have a national crisis in educating our children. Over 8,000 young people drop out of high school every day, and those are the ones that make it to high school. So I'm sitting here with Kanasia Han from City of Dreams and Demondre Harrison from Alive and Free. They are both students from Bayview Hunters Point here in San Francisco, and we're going to have a little conversation with them about their experiences in the school system. So let's welcome them both. So both of you, let's just start off with, tell me a little bit about your experience in the school system. When I just say those words, my experience in the school system for all these years, what leaps to your mind?
Well, how you guys doing? I'm a little nervous, but my thing is, it was tough. It was hard. You know, the opportunity that's in these school systems for different races compared to Latinos and African Americans is not the same. You know, we don't have the opportunity to take AP classes at my school that I attended. We didn't have the opportunity to, you know, take college prep classes as well as get that extra help that we needed. And it was very tough. You really got to get out there and do it on your own as opposed to having people help you out and really just put their hand out for you. You got to go and get it on your own.
Kanasia?
I've always felt like growing up, African Americans were the least, like the downgrade, and I always felt like I needed to do better, better than the best. Because, like, if you only do the average, then you won't make it. So I felt like if I'm gonna be something, then I need to be better than what I seen or what I was taught. Yeah.
It made me think of, are there any particular incidents that you can recall in, you know, you're a junior now, right?
Yes.
And you are a graduating senior. Any particular incidents stick out that just leap to your mind or come to your mind about, ooh, this isn't, something's not right here, something's not fair here? Anything you can think of?
Well, my senior year, I finally decided to take AP classes, and I was in class, it was nothing but Asians and whites. And every time I answered a question, they kind of giggled, and like, because I got the wrong answer. And they're all sophomores too, so they're starting at an early age. I was a senior. They were all sophomores and juniors. They were just sophomores. They weren't even juniors yet. And it's like, I didn't even know about AP classes until my senior year. So it's like that opportunity there was just completely X'd out for me. And I started completely late, so they're getting a 2-year jump ahead of me, where I just now started, as well as when we went to school, like the principal and all the faculty and stuff like that would think that African Americans would smoke weed and, you know, had carried guns and stuff like that. But in fact, it would be Asians that have pills and that's selling it to people in the school system. And they would come to school high and they would just walk around and go right past the security guard and everything. It wouldn't ask them no questions, none of that. If it was a black person, they'll stop you, bring you to the office, and they'll get you out of there. Because now the system, the school system is filled with more Asians and less black people. It was only like eight African-American males that graduated from my school. So, yeah.
Thank you.
I seen the difference between my middle school and my high school. Where my middle school, it was more white teachers than black teachers. It was about, I had two teachers that were black. And the difference between the black ones where they treated me as if, I don't know, like I was their own. And if I was in a white class, I mean, a white teacher was teaching me, he would like pick on me. Like if I was to ask questions, he would, I mean, I wouldn't say challenge, but it's like he was beating up on me that it's like to the ability that I couldn't, you know, reach, like mm-hmm. get it. But, I feel like I'm the only one in the classroom getting the spotlight. Why only me? Like it's because, and I feel like I was the only black person too. And it's like, why only me? Because of my color or because the way I think, or is it just me? Like, what is it?
That's a good question. That's why we're having a conversation. you know, one of the things I know being an educator, I always used to go to kindergarten classes and do this sometimes. Let's go to kindergarten class and watch the kindergartners. And they're like, just ask one of them a question. Everybody's hand is like this, right? And stick with them for a while, because actually I see this. And all that, I want to answer every question. By the time they get to the sixth grade, they have decided that school is not the place for them. And you can see it. You can see it right in front. And I'm not sure when the decision is made. And you remember the classmates you were in the kindergarten with, and first grade, second grade, third grade, because they want to go to school. They're ready to learn. They're eager. Something happens that makes them decide that, you know, this isn't the place for me. You have any thoughts about that? Why they get turned off, so many of them?
Well, I feel that it starts with the household and the community. Families, African-American families and Latino families aren't installing school into their kids at that age anymore. It's not a priority. Opposed to Asian or Caucasian, they're doing college prep classes. They're preparing for the SAT. You know, I didn't prepare for the SAT until my junior year and really take it serious. But I know former people that are studying sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, and they're opposite race. So it's like the family doesn't install education. And I feel like sports do play a part in it. That's a toll on African Americans and Latinos. They're thinking just sports is gonna get them there, but the odds are against you. It's one in a million that make it, and school is not there at all if they don't install it into the community or the family.
What are your thoughts about that?
Because I grew up in a community where it was cool for girls. Well, girls were popular if they shake their butt in videos, or they don't know their baby daddy. And it was fine if they didn't graduate from high school or college, because they can get a job on the street. I mean, it's money too, right?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot we could more to discuss here. And we got a short period of time, but just for my, let me throw the word disproportionality out there. Going to any school, and I'll watch this, how the special ed population grows increasingly, particularly black male, as you go further and further into the school system. Just from my experience, both being a teacher and administrator, the expectations put on a lot of you seem how they just don't believe that you can do it. Somehow. Did you ever feel that, you know, that they did, you know, I'm not sure that somehow the message is given to you, I'm not sure you can really cut it here.
Yeah.
You've experienced that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I've definitely experienced it. You know, my dad was a high school dropout, as well as his father. It was a cycle that trickles down. And I broke that cycle, and I'm proud of it. So,
I think what you're hearing, folks, here is a subtle feeling that even when they start out like this, at some point they feel like this isn't the place for me. So let me just talk about not so much an ask, but something that we're doing. A number of us in the city of San Francisco, those that work with youth, particularly in after-school programs, have engaged with the school district to wrap our arms around as many African-American students, starting with males and we'll move to the young women, as we can in the next school year. And I do want to say, in conversations with the school district, they have said, yes, you can do this. I met with the superintendents. We're meeting with the principals next week to try and actually do something about all the things you heard here tonight. And if it doesn't happen, it will not be for lack of effort on the part of the community. Keep that in mind. Thank you very much. Oh, ask? They want you to make an ask. Make an ask. Ask whatever you want. Ask. You got a scholarship, Mike? Okay, ask. Ask. Something you think is needed.
Well, I feel that you guys, you know, I feel that everybody should have equal opportunity. I feel that you guys should all reach out to everybody. Everybody's equal in reality, and we need to bring youth together, because nowadays youth are everywhere, and older adults, everybody's for themselves. We need to come be a unit. We need to come together as people, because in society today, everybody's so focused on themselves, and we need to be focused as one unit together, and that's what I feel. We should just bring everybody together and not play the race card or anything. Just help one another. Help each other, people. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Canadian?
Not much. I just ask that you don't doubt me.
That's a great ask.
You believe I can make it, I'm going to make it.
Thank both of you. That's very courageous for them to get up here. Next. Thank you. Next, we have Nikki Henderson, founder of People's Grocery, to talk about food justice. But first, Josh Merchant, talking about food, is a slam poet from Oakland. He has his first book of poetry coming out, and we want to welcome him. Come on.
Hi. Hello. my name is Joshua Merchant. I'm 22. I'm from East Oakland. I'm here on behalf of Youth Speaks, which is a nonprofit literary arts organization that does a lot of work throughout the Bay Area. And I'm a poet, and I'm really nervous, but it's cool. And the title of this poem is called Product of His Environment. James is in the eighth grade. Doesn't have enough money to support his own diet. Not a vegetarian out of fear of starving in his own home. Doesn't know what it's like to work in a factory, but he pictures something similar to his current public school with all the bells ringing in his ears, telling him what to do and when to do it. Now, when he first imagined farming, he saw straw hats, cows, pitchforks, and barns. It was like a fairy tale. He didn't know about the mounds of metal and synthetic material used to create what he eats. Because of this twisted food system he's subdued to, his body is systematically inclined to break down, like the buildings that were broke down for new shopping centers forcing his neighbors into homelessness. At this rate, he won't be able to differentiate corporate farmers from drug dealers. Similarities are too strong. Selling harmful products to innocent people for extensive profits, but like crack, the dollar menu is cheap. The ingredients are addicting. He keeps buying from them when James wakes up in the morning. The most difficult question he has regarding food is, how much is there in the fridge? 3 boxes of generic pasta in the freezer. 1 box of Captain Crunch he might have if there's any milk left. He'd build walls out of sugar. Easy to hide behind the focus of issues bombarding. Told you I was nervous. Easy to hide behind taste buds bombarding the focus of issues in his life. It's like being high for at least 10 minutes whenever he's able to find room to consume. He's not eating for the economy or for the geological state of the planet. He's eating for personal survival. Not realizing he's hurting himself in the process, James has never experienced the taste of fruits that haven't been attacked by pesticides, just like he's never experienced a neighborhood that hasn't been attacked by bullets. Some things just go hand in hand in his life. Corruption and lack of money, money and lack of opportunity, opportunity and non-organic meals. He can't hear the cries of exploited farmers when he bites into Big Macs because the cries of mothers with shattered backs from their seeds slipping into cracks with no sunlight are a little bit louder and too close to home. The blood permanently marked on his flesh from a friend dying in his arms is a little bit brighter to see than the tears of slaughtered animals. He was raised to treat spilled milk the same way he treats spilled blood. Gotta suck it up. Doesn't matter if it's full of pus lying across the floor. His mother paid too much for it. Suck it up. Doesn't matter if wounds are fresh with gunpowder. Tears won't fill bellies or heal scars. He's not worrying about eating responsibly. His responsibility is to shut down the sound of his stomach growling. He hates that noise. It's a constant reminder that he is a product of his environment, genetically modified to fail bloodlines to the stores of ancestors, harvested from their natural habitat, shipped across the ocean in tight packaging in order to be processed in the free laborers. He can still feel the whips of approval on his back. James can't take being a part of two uncontrollable, destructive systems at the same time. He wants to forget it all. As his body is getting weaker, his heart, the bridge between his mind and body, is leading the way to his unhealthy soul. Thank you.
That was intense. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to start with a request for grace, because this conversation is living very close to the surface for me. So I'm going to do my very best. But if I get emotional, I'm not going to apologize. I'm just going to say, go with it. Go with me for a second. So my name is Nikki Henderson, and I'm the executive director of People's Grocery in West Oakland. And I was hoping to bridge a bit of the visceral emotional response that I've been feeling from the poets with some of the information that we've been getting tonight with a personal story. Because that was really where all of this started for me as a young African American, a woman growing up in Los Angeles. I am the daughter of two people that are very active in community. My father was student body president as a sophomore, brought Stokely Carmichael to speak at UC Santa Cruz, super involved, fairly angry, grew up on welfare, very poor, majored in economics, wanted to do something with his life. And when he thought about what he could do as a black man that would have the most impact on society, what he came to was being a father. He could raise his children. And to me, that still is so profound, because he spent his whole life raising children, raising his own and raising other people's. I grew up with seven older foster brothers, and my parents run a foster family agency together. He's the executive director, she's the administrator and psychologist in residence. And that's what they've done since I was four. And then my mother, when it comes to what she wanted to do, the impact of the world, she wanted to raise healthy children. So I have all these stories about the diet that she was on before she got pregnant, the diet she was on during pregnancy, the diet she was on after we were born while she was breastfeeding, the diet she had us on while we were growing up. That's all she talked about, basically. And that's a lot of my memories growing up, was drinking that nasty wheatgrass and throwing up into the brown paper bag next to it, because we had to be healthy. She was really clear. And why was that so important? I started to learn why that was so important when I went into middle school and my grandfather started having problems with his legs. And when my mom, when I asked my mom about what was going on with him, she said that he had diabetes. And I said, what does that have to do with his legs? And she started explaining things to me. Circulation problems that affect different limbs, and that that's actually why Aunt Mildred's leg was amputated. And that my aunt also had diabetes. And I started going down the list of people in my family who had these severe health issues and realized that my immediate family were the only ones that weren't suffering from any of them. And I have a huge family, y'all. Huge family. Everyone was suffering from something. And the elderly people in my family, barely any of them die without having something amputated. A toe here, a leg there. So this lives very close to the surface for me, especially because my parents' marriage of social activism in the community with young black men and social activism around health and food, they walked in parallel. And I feel like that's what my life has become. Because at the same time I was eating very healthy as a high schooler and coming home to well-cooked meals, when I was 15, my foster brother was murdered very violently. And these were the things that I just walked parallel. That was why that poem was so profound for me. I grew up as a part of both of those systems. I can't detangle them. I've never been able to detangle them. And it lives very presently because Trayvon Martin was going to the liquor store to get Skittles and iced tea. That's what he was doing when he was out late at night. So many of our kids do. One of the things that People's Grocery is doing around our grocery store project is to make it more than a grocery store. That's part of the tagline. Part of that is so that it is well lit. Part of that is so that there are evening activities on the front porch so that kids don't have to walk late at night with no streetlights to get food. And so I feel like part of what I want people to latch onto and part of what I want people to feel in their guts around food and health and African American communities is that the things that we experience every day, the survival mode rat race that is experienced by so much of us every day, is not divorced from any of these other issues we deal with. Housing and health and education and policy all live close to the surface in us when our children are murdered. It's all the same story. And if I had to make an ask of you, if I had to try to bring it all together, one of the things that comes up for me at People's Grocery all the time is this issue of translation. To do some real talk for just a split second with y'all. I am safe. As an African American woman, I can come up on stage and have an educated conversation with you about race without screaming, even though that's what I want to do. I want to burst into tears and lie on the ground and scream. But I am safe. I can come up here and have a civilized, cordial dialogue with you. And I consider this a privilege, because for some, whatever reason, whatever my parents gave me when they raised me, I'm resourced enough to be able to scream and cry in one part of me and have this conversation with you in another. I'm a bridge. I can translate when that young brother is so angry, he's throwing bottles against the street and people are terrified of him. I can translate and say, you know what? You came to me to ask me about that because it scares you. I feel like that too. Do you want to sit down and have a conversation about why? So my ask to you is that you be a translator. You find that thing within your people that is hard to understand because it is complex and it is scary. Whoever your people are, however you define that. And you find a way to take that screaming part of you and have a cordial conversation about it without dampening or at all suppressing that part of you that needs to scream, because that part of you is real. Be grateful for it because it keeps you safe and because it validates the struggle that so many people who can't not scream feel. But if you have the opportunity to be a bridge, be the bridge. That would be my request. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki Henderson and Josh Merchant. As a reminder now, this is Inforum at the Commonwealth Club, and tonight we're hosting a town hall meeting on the politics of being black in the Bay Area. You can find out more about Inforum and the club hotline, commonwealthclub.org, or by becoming a fan on Facebook or Twitter. Next, we have a conversation about local and national policy and what you can do about it. Please welcome Paul Henderson and Angela Glover Blackwell. I lost something.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. This has been quite an extraordinary evening. It's been an honor to be here and sit and listen. How about you?
I've got a range of emotions. Mm-hmm. This is all taking me through. It's a lot of highs, a lot of lows, too. It's pretty emotional, though.
I know that people are expecting us to talk about policy, national and local, and we will. But as we start talking about policy, I want you to hold on to the feeling that you've gotten from listening to the artists. I want you to hold on to the truth you got from listening to the young people. I want you to hold on to the little bit of church we had. I thank you. That was very good to be able to think about this in that context as we talk about policy, because sometimes policy seems removed. But it's not, is it?
It never
is. Everything we're talking about is about policy, because every word that has been spoken is the result of decisions that have been made by people who control the resources, people who decide how we're going to live, where you're going to go to school, what kind of job you're going to have. This is all controlled by policy. And so what I want people to do is to think about our ability as voters, as participants, those of us who are civically engaged, to be able to do something about the image of black men and boys that allows for racial profiling, that the way that we have allowed our criminal justice system to be able to have an image of black and brown boys is all about criminality. That can be changed by policy. I'm going to mention a couple of things that need to happen at the national level, and I hope you'll talk about what's happening here.
I'm happy to. Jump on in and tell us a little bit about who you are.
Oh, that's not important.
Oh, it's always relevant. It's always relevant.
I'm Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO of Policy Link, a national organization advancing a new generation of policies that achieve a fully inclusive society. And I want to talk about incarceration. And when we think about incarceration, we can't start there. We have to go back to birth, prenatal care, early childhood, starting school ready to learn, going to a good school, having expectations, having good teachers, having schools that prepare children to reach their full potential. If we did all of that, we wouldn't even be having the incarceration conversation. But once you start having it, we need to stop feeding the incarceration system by first suspending young people, expelling young people, and then getting them into the juvenile justice system where they just get labeled and it's inevitable. We need to get young people out of there. There are other ways to deal with it. Then we need to make sure that we have a fair system. We need to stop these drug laws that allow some people to have to stay in for long periods and others not. We need to make sure there's a way for those who are in unfairly to get out. We need to make sure that people who are in are prepared to come out and be fully contributing. And we need to make sure that when people do come out, we welcome them, we have jobs, we have homes, and we allow people to be able to get back on track. What's happening in the Bay Area, if that's the national consensus about what needs to happen?
There's a lot happening in the Bay Area. Thank you for having me. My name is Paul Henderson. I'm the mayor's deputy chief of staff. I focus a lot on public safety. My previous position, I was chief at the district attorney's office here in San Francisco. And I served as the chief for Kamala Harris for the last 4 years before she became AG.
And I'm the on-air legal analyst for CBS. And I'm from San Francisco. I'm fourth generation San Franciscan here in the Bayview. I'm the first generation not to grow up in public housing. And my parents always like to point that out to me, although it was across the street. I mean, it was right down the line.
But you weren't in it.
Right. But they get very mad. It was down the block. We worked very hard, and you are not in public housing. Although I went to school in public housing. And, you know, I grew up here, and, you know, I'm trying to present the lens of the local experience while I'm up here because there were a lot of challenges along the way. I always like to come into the room because I feel like people hear my titles or they hear me speak and they forget or they remove me from the community. So I love to walk into a room when I talk about the criminal justice system or I talk about our justice system, and you know I get real self-righteous with it and start the conversation with, let's talk about how many people in this room have been arrested before and how many times. And raise your hand. Oh, I didn't mean you didn't have to. I'm putting it in context of how I start my conversations. So, this is what I do in City Hall, because you'd be surprised. People go right there, and they're like blinking. Do I raise my hand? What do I say? And I like to talk about it. You know, I've been arrested at least 8 times for everything from fare evasion to armed robbery. And not that I did those. I see you looking at me. I didn't do all of those things. But it puts it in context. And it changes the perspective that people have about my titles, my position, and the reality of who I am. And I went to schools here, and there were challenges. I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to go to a prep school. So there were here. So there were 5 other African Americans with me. And that was still not a pathway to success. I remember this, and this is one of the painful things, and I like to talk about these things now. These were things when I was growing up were really difficult for me and painful for me, and I like to talk about them now because I know my experience is not unique and common to me, and I know other people hear them and they are strengthened by them. I left from my prep school and applied to college without letters of recommendation because my counselors told me that I wasn't college material. And I was too embarrassed to tell my parents that I couldn't go to college, so I just applied without those letters and got in. And it was fine, and it wasn't until years later that I could get past my shame and have these conversations about the challenges that I had, especially as they related to poverty in education.
Could I ask you something? Well, I just want you to talk about the criminal justice system here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Is it getting better? Does it have all the problems I talked about? Is there a movement forward?
It's got those problems and then some understand the layers and the complexities in that. But it has always been a mission for me to make that process more inclusive rather than less inclusive. And if you are not at the table participating in those discussions, I think it's very difficult to ask for change and expect change, and that's why as much challenge as I faced in going to the district attorney's office and becoming a prosecutor, my mother was a public defender, so nobody celebrated for me and said, yay, prosecution, but I knew that the prosecution made the decision.
So let me take some other issues, though, because I do think what I want this audience to know is that there's a policy agenda out there that we ought to be pursuing, and I want to underline the urgency of it now, that we have for always, the history of this nation has really been based on racism. Slavery, you know, predated the founding of the nation, so it was founded on a racist system that was supported by policy. And I don't need to go all the way back to then, just go back to 1963, because we're going to celebrate next month the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Then the unemployment rate among black people was twice that it was among white people. It still is.
More.
Then the majority, overwhelming majority, of black children went to segregated schools. Right now, 74% of all black children go to segregated schools. The poverty rate in the country is now 3 times that of it is in the white community, and the agenda of employment and housing and education, which was the agenda then, is still the agenda. So we have to understand that the problem that got defined in 1963 as a problem of black people is now a problem for Latino people. It always was a problem for Native American, and there are many Asian groups that are suffering from the same problems. And we, as a group, people of color, we're becoming the majority. The majority of babies born in this country are of color, 73%. Of all children in the state of California are of color. If they don't do well, America does not do well. There is a new urgency to getting it right. And one of the most important issues is being able to improve the places where low-income children of color live.
How can we get involved in that policy?
In America, where you live is a proxy for opportunity. Mm-hmm. If you want to change that, you have to demand that we really do enforce the fair housing laws. Housing discrimination is as prevalent as ever. We as a community have to demand that we allow people to be able to live in communities rich with opportunity and not always keeping people in places that don't have it. Education, it's a scandal. The way that we underfund education, the way that we sit here and allow for schools across town to fail our children. As taxpayers, as citizens, as residents, we can't have that. We have to vote. We have to educate ourselves. When you ask me what I want people to do, I want you to download this book, allinnation.org. It's just out from PolicyLink last week and the Center for American Progress, and it takes every one of the areas that I've talked about, and it says exactly what we need to do to make a difference.
And let me just say, too, because I think the solution is inclusion,
yep.
That we cannot sit on the sidelines and expect for society to change. We have to make our voices heard, and there are things that you can do. As unempowered as you feel like you may be, there are steps that you can take. Even if that step is nothing more than when you see leadership, when you hear leadership, to make that call and say, how can I support you? How can I work with you? I appreciate your voice and what you're saying and where you're going, and how can I follow in that direction? I want everybody to leave here feeling as they are empowered as an agent of change, that they will do one thing, even if that's nothing more than posting something on your Facebook page about the ideas that you've heard tonight, to encourage your friends, your peers, your families to do that one thing that's going to make a difference. And then the other thing that you can do is you walk out, for anybody that is not registered to vote tonight, can step outside and register to vote. And please take that with you and encourage your neighbors to take that with you. Take that to your family, to your friends, to your peers. And then when you give it to them, also tell them to participate in the criminal justice system and do their jury duty.
And there's one other thing we can do.
And
this is the hardest of all. And that is, you can challenge your friends and your family members and your coworkers and the students that you're with, because all of us experience it, and we experience it a lot with the Trayvon Martin atrocity and the acquittal of George Zimmerman. We hear people saying things that are not right. We hear people saying things that are hurtful. We hear people saying things that are uninformed, and it always puts a pit in your stomach when you have to challenge your aunt, your friend, your coworker, your faith leader. But it's up to all of us to do it. If every one of us would just say that when I am in a room, no matter who you are in the world, your back is covered. I'm not going to let you be maligned. I'm not going to let anybody use racial slurs. I'm not going to let anybody say something that I know would hurt you if it was said to your face. If we would do that, we could make it a better place. Thank
you. Where can we find this book?
You can find this book at allinnation.org or on the PolicyLink website.
I don't have a book. I'll be on Facebook. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson and Ms. Glover-Blackwell. An amazing way to end our lineup of speakers. Now it's time for questions from our audience. Please line up at your microphones. Uno. There's going to be a dose in a minute. That's all I know. In each aisle, please be respectful of our speakers, of each other, and keep your questions short and one part each. so that we can hear from as many people as possible. If I cut you off, don't take it personal, and move on to the next questionnaire, it is only to engage as many people as possible. Now, as a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're here for the Politics of Black in the Bay Area, a town hall meeting. And we are here with, one more time we'll introduce him, Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO of Policy Link, John Burris, civil rights attorney, Kanasia Han, City of Dreams student speaker, Demondre, let me get your link back. Yep. We cannot have Mr. Burris. A lot of people need him. Demondre Harrison, a live and free student speaker, slam poets Joss Merchant and Sojari Bradley, Kevin Epps, filmmaker and community activist, Nikki Henderson, executive director, People's Grocery, Paul Henderson, deputy chief of staff and director of public safety in San Francisco, Pastor Michael McBride, lead pastor, The Way Christian Center, and I'm Dr. Joseph Marshall, founder of Alive and Free, and the host of Street Soldiers and your MC for tonight. Now, before we begin, I did not make my ask, but I am a teacher. Since I'm a teacher, I'm going to give you some homework. A couple of things, and you heard one of them. You heard John Burr, I think it was John, and if I'm correct, help me. He said, go see the film Fruitvale Station. Absolute must. And if you really want, yeah, here's the one thing. Working with young people, I don't like to hear. I didn't know. Fruitvale Station will open your eyes to a lot that you don't know. I'll ask one more thing. I will ask this. There's a book you should all read. We haven't said the book tonight, but please, please read Michelle Alexander's, forgot the book real quick. I'm sorry, The New Jim Crow. Got the book in my mind. Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. You will learn a lot. You will learn about why the things that are happening, that they are happening. So with that, we begin with you. And now the first question from our audience, and we will begin over here. Yes, sir. Sure.
Yeah. First of all, one love is to all the young people and the entire panel. Great job. But directed to Mr. Henderson, the question is, sometimes we get involved as a result of a nonprofit organization with criminal justice system and appearing on behalf of oftentimes young people that are before the justice system. In my experience is that it's so adversarial that if they don't have some outside people coming in, they're going to get railroaded. That shouldn't be. It's that we stand before the DA says the people versus the people ain't for railroading somebody just because the DA has the upper hand. Instead of looking, how do we engage and interject a fairness element? Because I just appeared 2 months ago, you're ready to give this young man 5-year state penitentiary time. I appeared and all of a sudden said, we'll do this for him. They gave him probation.
Okay, specifically.
So it's a question. How do we change that adversary? It ain't right. Just because
let him answer the question.
All right.
Great. Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well,
go ahead.
I got the microphone. Let me tell you. So, you know, the first step is, again, inclusion. I think that when you have more faces that look like mine as part of the discussion representing the prosecution team, you change the whole dynamic of the conversation. And part of the problem that we have had historically with prosecution is that the people who have sat at the table and who have made those decisions have not come from the very communities that are a part of the mass incarceration process. And so the fact that community-based organizations are coming and standing up for the disenfranchised communities, and I'm not even just going to say the African-American communities because it's the black and brown and, you know, there are a number of communities that are over-incarcerated there, but that process makes a difference. The fact that the community organizations can come to the courtroom and speak on behalf of the community for these people that are being prosecuted, I think is really important. But I think a more important step is if we can change the face and the process of people that are coming, that are making decisions about the individual cases that get prosecuted in the first place.
So, sir, I want to stop on. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I got a lot of questions. Mr. Walker.
I'd just like to say to the Commonwealth Club, thank you. But I'd also like to say And a lot of black people here, and I've never had the opportunity to be at this place, but do y'all know that it is still a move to run all black people out of San Francisco? Do you know that all of the grants that black people used to get, they don't do that no more? This mayor has decided to take it upon himself to run black people out of San Francisco. That is all a part of the educational system. This is a capitalistic society. And I think a lot of time we start to fight, but it's sad to say that it takes a Martin case with Zimmerman to bring us together and bring us together to say Asian people and black people don't get along because the mad don't like us. And I want y'all to know that right as we talk tonight, they are trying to drive our people out of San Francisco. And I want to know from them,
we need a question.
What do you think can be done about them stopping?
Thank you. We need a question. Anyone want to tackle that?
The problem of gentrification, and I know you are talking about much more than that, so I'm just going to take the problem of gentrification because it is a huge problem. We have communities that have been low income with failing schools and dangerous and no place to get fresh fruits and vegetables. And then we have a movement in the other direction where people start to fix all of that. And the first thing that happens is the people who were there during the bad times are not able to stay and enjoy the good times. Maintaining affordable housing has been the real problem in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and Boston and Chicago. All of these places that those people who are now empty nesters want to come back to and enjoy city life, those young people who grew up in the suburbs aren't interested in the suburbs anymore, and we have a new interest in cities, but we're not maintaining affordability for people to stay there. I think that we have an obligation as people who vote, as people who are civically engaged, to stand up for affordable housing and not just an affordable unit, an affordable family unit. When cities start building affordable housing downtown, it's for singles. It's for people who are childless. We need apartments with 2 and 3 bedrooms so that people with families can stay in cities. And that is a policy agenda that needs to be taken up.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks, everybody. Okay, here's my question. First comes the statement that the American Civil Liberties Union has worked on driving while black, has worked on racial profiling, has worked on representation in the courts, has worked, okay, all those things. I live in Richmond. The ACLU continues to be thought of as a white elite organization. You were talking about policy. Well, one of the things they address is policy. And so you want to go in, you participate in things that are important to the community itself. You don't try to tell people what to do. But the question is, when something is stonewalled, which it feels like it is, like, no, how do you get beyond that? I mean, this is real specific.
Can I just say, I think you just have to keep trying. And when you get your no, then you turn to your elected officials to find out who supports your values and your position, and not be afraid to go to those elected officials and say, I want you to take a position like this because I'm being stonewalled. And then you follow up and support that.
Yeah, because the question is, who is the no coming from? And that's the most important question. I mean, if it's from a court, that's one thing. That might depend on what you do. But generally, if it's no on a policy question, then it becomes political in terms of who makes that decision. And so that's where all the conversation we're always talking about is voting. Voting. Voting matters. And I'll say this throughout the country because it's not just here. You got to look to see what happens in midterm elections. Because what has happened in this country now is that the Republicans were able to put forth an agenda based upon the midterm election, and it's having an adverse effect on women's rights throughout the country. It's having an adverse effect on the ability to vote in various communities, and it's going to have an adverse effect on a lot of things that are going to be important to you. So the question is, who's making the decision for no? Yeah. And ultimately, that may translate into a political process. Okay. And that means, obviously, you've got to get people to the polls to vote.
Can I just add one thing? Quickly.
I am convinced that the challenges of the Bay Area are not because of the Tea Party. This is a progressive area of the country, which leads me to believe that progressives are not doing the work necessary around a racial justice agenda. So part of what I believe is critically important for us to all own, because it's easy for us to put blame on someone else and abdicate our own personal responsibility. We must all look at ourselves in the mirror and face the demons that still torment us day to day around race, around fairness, and organize ourselves around this agenda that Dr. Blackwell and many others are doing. I believe that the people closest to the pain should lead in the organizing work and not be led along by people who have no idea what to do in the first place. So organize. Organize with people of color and trust that they have the solutions to their own problems and think that they can lead you.
When a reverend is going, it's hard to stop him, but amen. And I've been told there cannot be a wind-up. It can't be a statement first. There's got to be a question right out the gate, okay? Or we'll never get through this. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just want to have a question specifically for the students. So I watched this video on HBO, and basically it was talking about this school that was able to attain 100% graduation rate for black students. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they did was they really took a village approach. So the question is posed to the students, but also to the community. Would it make sense that if every one of us in this room, white, black, Latino, what have you, would either adopt a student or a family to actually expose them? So when you go on family vacations, you take that kid with you. When you go out to eat at a nice restaurant, you take that kid, basically exposing them to your life outside their community so that they have an opportunity to see what the world is that they can live in and how they can make their community.
Okay, let me let the students answer that question.
Okay, I would say yes, because we don't have that in our families at home anymore. We don't have that. We don't have a family that's taking on some vacations. All we know is San Francisco, Hunters Point. We stuck so much on our community. It would be nice. We seek for help elsewhere at the school, and they're disregarding us and helping us and stuff like that nowadays, but it would be helpful and it would be a blessing, and we would love that, and I feel that we'd be in a better place, because that's where I had seeked it, in other places from other people, not my family.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next question. Next question.
Okay. I'm sort of speechless. I don't know what to say. I am a family therapist, professional mediator, and I live in Oakland, and my uncle was the first African-American mayor in Oakland, Lionel Wilson. My dad was a civil rights attorney. Unfortunately, neither of them are still around. I was living in Colorado, and I've moved back. And my question is, something I'm wanting to do something in terms of something that Obama has said, that we need some conversations about race. I led a conversation during the Rodney King thing to talk about race then. I'm wanting to do something in my community in Oakland. I live in Rockridge now. And I'm wanting to figure out how to bring the right stakeholders in, because I'm a facilitator, professional facilitator, and I want to figure out what to do in my beloved Oakland.
Okay. Anybody want to talk about what I know that... go ahead.
So I feel like one of the concentrations around today's talk should be to definitely humanize black and brown youth. I think if your heart is in it, I think if you have a heart to see black and brown youth for who they are exactly, then that is over probably 85 to 95% of that work. I think a large problem is that in our communities we aren't seen as human beings. And so, you know, in my work I try to emphasize that as often as possible. And it's not so much about this kind of false caring, right? It's actually about this authentic type of caring that deals with you investing in these kids' lives. So if you genuinely care, they become ultimately a part of your life. And it goes beyond race. It goes beyond color. It goes way beyond, you know what I'm saying, these stereotypical human connections that we make on a day-to-day basis. So I guess, you know, if anything, I would want people to walk away today with investing in a student's life authentically and not superficially.
And ma'am, let me give you a direct somebody to plug into Pastor McBride. He'll help you. Okay? After this, just run up to him, plug in, he will help you with that. Next. Right here.
My question is for the young people, specifically Ms. Han and Mr. Harrison. Thank you for your bravery in being here and speaking to us about your experiences. I work at Policy Link, where we lift up what works, and I want to know what you feel has worked for you. You talked about overcoming a lot of things to be in the situation that you're in now, having to fight to be in AP classes, et cetera. What were the things that actually worked for you in your education and in your path until now?
What are the things that worked for you in your education?
Where did you find any of the help that you needed, or what worked for you? What sort of resources did you find at some point that worked for you? Like, what can we keep investing in? What actually is working?
What really helped me was supportive teachers, counselors, just people who supported me and believed in me, and I felt like if they believed in me, I could do it too.
What worked for me was the programs. They got gear up programs and stuff like that, and college prep programs and mentors. And people, these organizations are losing, and they're taking them out of schools. Like the gear up program that I was in, they're no longer having that at the school anymore, and that's what really helped me. So we need to continue to have more programs and continue to help them grow instead of stripping them from the schools, because if we strip them, then nobody's going to get help. And we can't seek out to help the people that really need it.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Cedric. My name is Cedric Jackson. I'm the president of the San Francisco Black Leadership Forum. And my question is actually around social justice and trying to find how we inform social policy and national policy to address the weapon of social injustice, which is economics. And how do we then set a policy that we as a community can then strive for? So what I'm asking, Dr. Blackwell, is I'm asking for how do we get involved and how do we then form a policy that Mr. Henderson can then take to the city and county, and we can have our attorney Burris then act as our legal, you know, like spearhead behind it. And we and our pastors behind it. It's the question.
I see you're putting a team together, so let me ask her what she can do. I'm sure she, that doesn't bother Angela. Go right ahead.
And I believe in that, because I believe whatever you want to do, you have in the room what you need to start. The question is an excellent one. The comments about take a child on a vacation, that's do that. That is a wonderful thing to do, so I would never say don't do that. But mentoring is not a substitute for having a school system that works for all children, allows them to reach their full potential, go on and have full careers. We need to identify big policies that at a level of scale can be transformative. You said, what could we do? In San Francisco, San Francisco is a wealthy city, and this is a wealthy nation. America is not a poor country, and it needs to stop acting like one. Just needs to stop acting like one. But in San Francisco, which is a wealthy city that spends a lot of money on infrastructure and water and roads and all of those things, we need to demand that every public dollar that is spent gets some young person who needs a job back to work. That every public dollar that is spent, we have to ask, who's benefiting? Who decides? And how do we make sure that the agenda, which is the equity agenda, just and fair inclusion, is not just achieved with the small program over here, but it's achieved with every public dollar that we spend. Everybody who lives in San Francisco can lift that up. You can ask. You can go to the Board of Supervisors meetings, and you can say, I want to see what the budget is, and I want to know what's the litmus test. Where's the equity lens? Where's the fairness and the justice lens? So that every dollar that we spend is on the agenda of full inclusion. It is not just the moral thing to do. It's an economic imperative. Equity is the superior growth model for the future.
Thank you. Let me get one more. And I know this lady, so I got to get her in. Go ahead, quickly now. Okay. Go right ahead. Your question.
Okay, I'll just spit it out.
I've noticed that there's a really large disparity when it comes to employment in black people in the Bay Area. So I'm just wondering, why don't we get hired in this region?
Why don't
we get hired in this region, even with equal qualifications?
So to me, this goes back
to people who claim to be progressive, to be honest about the way in which race and implicit bias works on us in ways we are not aware of. It is also, I think, critical for us to think about not just why don't we get hired, but why aren't there more opportunities for entrepreneurship in our communities, which is often tied to policy conversation around, you know, loans being made available in our community so we can start our own businesses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So part of what I think my sister Sojari is talking about when we talk about humanizing and valuing the lives of everyone, I think we have to challenge our assumptions about who is competent, who is valuable, who can do the job. And all of us have to do that, dare I say, including black people, because we all have been produced out of a soil of racial bias in this country that we are not free from unless we seriously interrogate it together.
And can I springboard off of that and encourage, because I think that point is really important about us taking ownership to create and find those opportunities as well. I like to tell people, my office did not hire me when I first applied. I had to wait and come over as a lateral. And when I first, because, you know, I thought I was a star. But when I got there, my first priority was to put myself on the hiring committee. My first priority was to collect resumes and bring them to my office and say, these people are valued and these people are important. And I think that those are some of the things that we have to do as well. We cannot stand on the side and wait for other people or other communities or other agencies to do the work for us. We have to start where we are and try and open the doors for the people to come behind us to expand as well.
I've got to sign like 10 minutes ago. Let's give a big round of applause to all of our speakers. Now, don't go anywhere. For sharing their stories, their knowledge, and their solutions in the Commonwealth Club's Town Hall, the politics of being black in the Bay Area. Now, at this point, this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you very much.